From the studios of KUSP in Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. We welcome Mark Harris back to the show this week. Mark Harris is a contributing editor to Entertainment Weekly, and he's the author of the book Pictures at a Revolution, Five Movies and the Birth of the New Hollywood. His newest book is the highly acclaimed Five Came Back, A Story of Hollywood and the Second World War. Mark Harris, welcome back to From the Bookshelf.
Thanks so much for having me.
So this book has just gotten tremendous response. I even saw you on Meet the Press.
Yeah, my probably first and only time, but I've been really thrilled. This was a step into new territory for me because I usually write about movies, but I'm not any kind of a World War II expert.
Now you are.
Well, self-taught and taught by a lot of other good writers, I guess, too, who I read along the way. But
I'm sure we're going to see you soon wearing a necktie, sitting in front of a bunch of books in the next Ken Burns film.
I wanted to push myself out of my own comfort zone, and I certainly did that with this book, because I've spent my career writing about movies, but even in that case, these were the movies, and this was the period of movies that I had always kind of avoided without even realizing I was doing it. I would look at, you know, director's credits on IMDb and just not think very much about what happened in the gap between the movies they made before World War II and the movies they made when they came back.
Right. The title of your book, Five Came Back, tells us that it's really about how this experience of going to war, and you talk about, we'll just let everybody know, you talk about five directors, Frank Capra, John Huston, William Wyler, George Stevens, and John Ford, and about how they went to war and then how that experience of going to war affected them when they came back. And not only did it affect them, but it affected Mark Harris and Gary Shapiro and everyone else, because they made movies that were very different than the movies they made before they left.
Right. And I chose that title partly because it was easier than Pictures at a Revolution. After the first title, people were calling it Pictures at an Exhibition, Pictures of a Revolution, Pictures at a Revolution. So I wanted something sort of crisp and jaunty and easy to remember, and also something that sounded like a movie from that period, which, in fact, it was. There was a movie from 1939 called Five Came Back.
Lucy is in it.
Right, exactly. Mm-hmm. But also because coming back was, I always knew, going to be a really important part of the story. The book isn't just about why they went to war and what they did during the Second World War. It's about the couple of years leading up to the war that brought them to that decision point, and also about how successfully or unsuccessfully they reintegrated into an industry that had gone on without them, and also how they kind of transformed their own personal experience into their movie making.
But Mark Harris, you must really love the number five.
You know, it was sort of an accident. I'll tell you the truth. When I wrote the proposal for the book, my proposals, and this was true for the first book too, tend to be wildly overreaching, ambitious things that I realized at some point during the research would make really good 2,000-page books. So then after the proposal, I narrow them down a little bit. And the proposal for this book was originally about 12 or 14 different people, not just directors, but producers, studio heads, actresses, emigres. It was going to be, you know, the big book of everything to do with Hollywood and World War II. And there were fascinating stories to tell in every corner of that, but the more I looked into it, the more I realized that the directors themselves were a fascinating story, and a story that really deserved the complete spotlight and a book of their own. And then I had this kind of cringing realization that there were five of them. And so I looked around and thought, well, is there anyone I could add? And there really wasn't, because I was choosing directors who were in such unique positions. I mean, Capra, Wyler, and Ford were kind of at the top of Hollywood in different ways at that moment, and Stevens and Houston were getting there. So there really wasn't a sixth then powerful and important director to add, and there certainly wasn't one I could eliminate. I felt like each of the five of them brought something essential and unique to this story, so I just embraced it.
And so the next book is going to have something about five. We'll find out what they're going to take five. It's going to be 5 years until you write it. But
exactly.
Well, you mentioned the year 1939, the year of Five Came Back with Lucille Ball and some other people. And 1939 is, you know, kind of considered the greatest year in the history of Hollywood, and some of the greatest films Hollywood ever made were made in that year. And two of your filmmakers, at least, made two of their greatest films, respectively, in that era. Stagecoach by John Ford was made in 1939, and Mr. Smith Goes to Washington by Frank Capra made in 1939. I can't remember what Wyler or... Oh, I guess Wyler made Wuthering Heights in 1939, right?
Right. And, right.
And what about Stevens? What did he made...
Stevens was... I think he made Gunga Din in 1939. He was still, you know, Stevens was still before the war. He was a very well respected director, but he did not have the sort of reputation or acclaim that, you know, Capra, who was on the cover of Time magazine and was the richest director in Hollywood, did, or that Ford did, who was really coming to be seen as like the great social conscience of the movies. And Houston was not even a director yet in 1939. He was a pretty successful screenwriter trying to convince Warner Brothers to let him direct. He didn't make his first movie until 2 years later with The Maltese Falcon.
Well, and what a fantastic directorial debut that is. But I want to ask you about... Let's start with talking about George Stevens, because I think he really exemplifies the difference between the kinds of films these directors made before and after. Because he made Swing Time and Kentucky Colonels with Wheeler and Woolsey. And he made a lot of... he started, of course, doing Laurel and Hardy comedies, I believe.
Right, in the 1920s. He did Laurel and Hardy comedies. And you know, at the time that war broke out, Stevens was known as a really kind of elegant director of escapist romantic fare. I mean, they had a really great touch with things like Alice Adams with Katharine Hepburn, with Swing Time. He directed Ginger Rogers in one of her most fun performances in Vivacious Lady. Mm. And he was hungry to do more, hungry to prove he could do more socially relevant or important movies. You know, he was also absolutely ready to drop everything and just go. To all of these guys volunteered, they all sort of accepted officers' commissions to join the Army, or in Ford's case the Navy. The contrast between the kinds of movies they made before and after the war is really, really stark with Stevens, Stevens had in some ways the hardest, maybe the emotionally hardest war experience. He and Wyler, in different ways, were both very, very traumatized by the war. But Stevens, in particular, because he was one of the first filmmakers into the camps in 1945, and documented the atrocities he saw there for the Nuremberg trials, he really felt that experience made it impossible for him to direct comedy again. And in fact, he didn't, despite people who had been really close to him, like Katharine Hepburn, begging him to go back to comedy and saying it was what he was most naturally gifted at. On the other hand, the dramas he made after the war, things like Shane and A Place in the Sun and Giant, absolutely cemented his reputation as one of the first rank American directors.
And he also directed The Diary of Anne Frank, I believe.
Yes, he did, in 1959, and it's interesting because you'd look at his war experience and then you'd look at a movie like The Diary of Anne Frank and you'd think, well, that obviously 15 years later is how he brought his war experience to the screen. But Stevens always said that it was another movie, Shane, which he had made 6 years earlier, that was really what he considered his statement about World War II and violence and the impact of gunfire. Even though Shane was a Western, obviously not a war movie, emotionally, Stevens felt it was a more direct representation of what the war taught him.
I guess it's kind of considered tame now, but at the time when Jack Palance shoots Elijah Cook Jr., I think it is, and he flies back like about 6 feet, I don't know how they did that shot, that was, you know, that was incredibly violent for the period that Shane was made, and that was the kind of the beginning of that violence in the cinema, done, you know, before the demise of the production code.
I recently rewatched Shane, and I was really startled to see what a dark movie it was and what an adult movie it was. The complexity of the relationship between Shane and the boy's mother, you know, there's really beautiful, thoughtful, intelligent filmmaking in Shane. Like, it's the furthest thing from a sort of crowd-pleasing Western. Nothing in it is forced, but nothing in it is by accident either. It's a really incredibly thoughtful movie. I think one of the greatest, maybe the greatest in some ways, that Stevens ever made. I would certainly put it right up there with A Place in the Sun.
And what a great movie that is. We're talking with Mark Harris, and his new book is called Five Came Back, A Story of Hollywood and the Second World War, telling the story of five great film directors and their war experience. And I don't know, maybe you don't like Frank Capra's movies as much, but maybe you're not as kind to Frank Capra as some filmgoers. I mean, people love It's a Wonderful Life. You don't seem to love it that much.
I certainly hope that in the book I'm not unkind to him. But, you know, Capra is a really challenging director to write about. I think in some ways, when you look at his movies, he relied more on his screenwriters than any of the other directors I write about. So that, you know, the vision of a really wonderful movie, for instance, like Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, is as much the vision of Sidney Buckman, the screenwriter, as it is of Capra. And in a way, the character, the main character, is emotionally as much a creation of Jimmy Stewart as it is of Capra. It's not that I don't like It's a Wonderful Life, and obviously it's a classic that's since come to be beloved by generations. But the context in which I write about the movie is the context of Frank Capra returning home and really, really struggling emotionally to find his place in a Hollywood that he was very concerned had forgotten him and was insufficiently respectful of what he had accomplished before the war and during the war, because Capra really played the most important role in terms of coordinating the U.S. propaganda effort. So It's a Wonderful Life is the repository, the story of it is the repository of a lot of his fears about being forgotten. I mean, an early draft of It's a Wonderful Life had the alternate story was, what if George Bailey had been a bad person? Capra rewrote that to make it, what if George Bailey had never existed, which is how he was feeling that he was being treated. So I'm writing about it in terms of the movie being an expression of Capra at a very, very frustrated time in his life, and also because I was writing about It's a Wonderful Life in 1946, I had to tell the truth about it, which is that it was a failure. It was not exceptionally well received by critics. It didn't make a ton of money, and it bankrupted the company that Capra and Wyler and Stevens had all hoped to start together. So if I'm hard on the movie, it's only because the movie was really hard on Capra, and it was, in fact, it was the last movie of any importance that he ever made.
Yeah, and it's really ironic, isn't it? I mean, I think today, even though I think The Best Years of Our Lives is a fine, fine film, it's a wonderful film, but I think today most people don't know that film, and everybody knows It's a Wonderful Life.
Right. right. It's funny. You know, It's a Wonderful Life. Television was really kind to it. And Capra, who lived a very, very long time after he stopped making movies, did live long enough to see the movie start to be embraced by generations that had missed it the first time. But at the time, he was really devastated by not only by the failure of the movie, but by the failure of the company, which was really supposed to be, what we would now call an indie. Capra really did not want to be shackled by a studio contract anymore, and he kind of convinced Wyler and Stevens to go in with him on this venture that would have been, had it succeeded, a remarkable step forward into directorial independence. Each of the three guys was supposed to make three movies. They never got past the first one because It's a Wonderful Life turned out to be so expensive and so disappointing at the box office that there was just no future for the company, which was called Liberty.
They were really ahead of their time with that idea.
They really were. And I think they were also very much of their moment in that a lot of people who came back from the war, directors but also actors, felt like, they've just participated in something really important. They're not going back to these incredibly harsh and punitive rules where they were really kind of indentured servants of the studios, and the studios had the last word on everything. I mean, the end of World War II was not the end of the studio system by any means, but it was the beginning of the end of the studio system. It was the beginning of a 20-year process that by the time I get to 1963, which is where my other book begins, you really see the studio system on its last legs.
Yeah. And I guess in terms of the work that they did during the war, Capra is the one who people at the time were really aware of because he made those Why We Fight films that are still in circulation. People still see them.
Yeah, I mean, Capra, the Why We Fight films, which were a series of seven movies that were intended to explain basically the previous 10 years of German and Japanese history. The Why We Fight films were not intended to be shown to the general public, although three of them did get theatrical releases. They were meant to be shown to young GIs, draftees, who found the old Army training films really boring and silly and couldn't follow or pay attention to the spoken lectures that were part of their induction. So these movies replaced those lectures, and everybody who fought in World War II for the Americans saw them. And the fact that Capra pulled them off at incredible speed with almost no money, and even more remarkably than that, pretty much determining himself the answer to Why We Fight. Because, when we say he was a propagandist, he was also coming up with the message. He wasn't just taking dictation from the War Department. He was trying to craft the message himself. So what he did with those movies really won him the admiration of the entire industry. William Wyler, shortly after the war, said that he believed that the Why We Fight films would last longer and that history would prove them to be more important American movies than any of the major sort of Hollywood fictional films of that moment. And he wasn't right about that. The Why We Fight films, interestingly, sort of quickly became a kind of historical footnote. But I think it was that jolt of coming back, to an industry where your colleagues who knew what you did really thought you were a hero, but the rest of the industries had sort of gone on without you and didn't care, and there were suddenly new movie stars and you were only as good as your last picture. That was devastating for Capra. It was really, really hard for him, and understandably, I think.
Yeah, well, the war interrupted the careers of so many people and, of course, created the careers of so many others, including one of John Ford's great protégés, John Wayne. If not for the
right.
war, if not for the war, Wayne would probably have continued on as a cowboy actor or whatever. But because all the great stars were gone, Wayne had his day.
Right, and it particularly rankled Ford that during the war, Wayne, who managed to perpetually postpone the day when he would serve while always saying that it was just around the corner, became a bigger and bigger star in part by appearing in war movies. And you know, that led to, you know, Ford liked Wayne, and Wayne really revered Ford. And Ford's first movie after the war, it was really right after the war, was a World War II movie, one of the few he made, called They Were Expendable. And it co-starred Wayne and Robert Montgomery, who was an actor who had served and served very admirably in the war. And once Ford got on the set of that movie and started working directly with Wayne for the first time in many years, all of the resentment and contempt Ford felt for Wayne for not serving bubbled to the surface really quickly and manifested itself in a very, very ugly confrontation that came close to shutting down the movie.
Well, Ford was never very kind to Wayne.
You know, it's interesting because they went on and worked together, of course, many times after that. It, you know, when we think of all of the Ford's signature westerns that followed, They Were Expendable. You know, The Searchers and She Wore Yellow Ribbon and Man Who Shot Liberty Valance. You know, they never broke with each other in any way that that meant they wouldn't work together anymore. But it was a complicated, a really complicated relationship, I think.
I guess in some ways it's like Betty Davis and William Wyler. That is, regardless of what went on between them personally, they regarded their professional relationship so highly that they continued to work together.
Well, Betty Davis certainly felt that the three movies that she made for William Wyler before the war, which were The Letter and The Little Foxes and Jezebel, were the best work she had done on screen up to that point. That nobody understood how to direct her and how to use her and how to bring out the greatness in her like Wyler did, even though they ended up really, really fighting and breaking with each other to the point where they did not work together again after the war, which is something I think that she really regretted. And I know Wayne certainly felt that Ford was responsible for his best work on screen. I think that's really unarguable. I don't think there is a John Wayne who's any kind of a real American movie star if you subtract all the Ford movies from his resume.
What do you mean? You don't like Big Jim McLean?
No, he definitely made some other good movies. You know, when I was a kid, I saw The Shootist.
Oh, I love that.
And I really liked him in that. But yeah. But you know, he was in that movie trading on a sort of reputation that wouldn't have existed without.
Think there are scenes in that movie that were shot by Ford from earlier films or kind of references to them.
Yeah, definitely
still,
references.
Yeah. So. Yeah. Yeah, oh, that's a great film. I mean, I think he was a fine actor. Big Jim McLean is a terrible picture, but you know what I mean. We're talking with Mark Harris, and his latest book is called Five Came Back, A Story of Hollywood and the Second World War. And it's kind of interesting for you to go back in time and write about a period in which very few people are living. When you wrote your book about the Oscars of 1967, pretty much everybody was still around. I mean, I remember the 1967 pretty well, and I wasn't around for World War II. So how was the experience different from the first book?
Well, with the first book, which covered 1963 to 1968, because some of those movies had really long histories, I was already running into a little bit of trouble. I mean, for instance, you know, on Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, the director, Stanley Kramer, and the screenwriter, William Rose, and Katharine Hepburn and Spencer Tracy had all died, obviously, long before I started the book. For this book, which is set from 38 to 1946, I knew right from the beginning that I wasn't going to do interviews, because really, I mean, I could have interviewed directors' kids, I guess, but, you know, in terms of people who were alive and successful and powerful enough to have played an important role, even an important important peripheral role in the years I was writing about, Olivia de Havilland was about the only person I could think of. So it helped, actually, to know from the beginning that this was not going to be an interview-driven project. And before I ever sold the proposal for the book, I investigated to make sure that all of the people I wanted to write about had archived their materials. And I was really, really lucky that these directors, or their families in particular, had taken such pains to preserve their scripts, their letters, their wartime journals, their diary entries, their contracts, their rough drafts of speeches. I mean, going into those archives for the five guys really was the thing that allowed me to write the book, because that was the only way that I could hope to bring them to life.
So how long a process was it? I mean, you took 5 years to write this one?
I think it was about 4 years. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there was a gap. But in terms of actual work, it was about, close to 5 years, I guess. It was about 3.5 years of research and then about a year of writing.
But it's certainly been worth it because, gosh, the response to the book has been so great. I thought that your first book was an amazing and wonderful book, but this book really has gotten a lot of attention. Did that surprise you that it was so much... I guess it was the war aspect that gave it a broader audience?
When I'm writing, at least, I try never to think, you think in a vague way, I hope a lot of people will read this, but you never know. And what I'm really thinking most of the time is, I hope this story that I'm telling is as exciting to other people as it is to me. Like, I hope I can convey how fascinating I find all of this and why I find it fascinating to readers. So, I have been a little surprised. It's been incredibly gratifying to realize that this is a book that people were going to respond to, and it's been very meaningful for me to do readings and talks about this and have... guys come up to me and say that their fathers had served in World War II, as mine did, and that this, they were getting the book for their fathers, or that they were getting the book in memory of their fathers. And I'm also really happy that on the movie side of things, that movie buffs who are, much, much, much too young to have ever experienced these movies, as they came out. I mean, most of us are too young for that, but it's been really great that movie fans in their 20s and 30s have embraced the book and have actually made an effort to go back and watch for the first time some of the movies that I write about.
It's a fabulous book, and we've just only sort of touched about it. We didn't even talk about John Huston. Maybe you'll have to come back and we'll talk some more.
Gladly.
It's a great book. It's called... Five Came Back, A Story of Hollywood in the Second World War. The author is Mark Harris, and he does some fabulous work, not only in these books, but you can find him in the pages of Entertainment Weekly. If you missed his cover story on Michael Keaton a few weeks ago, you should go find that, because it really was great. And it's always a pleasure to talk to you, Mark. Thank you so much for being with us on From the Bookshelf.
Likewise, Gary. Thanks for having me.
That's all the time we have for From the Bookshelf this week. I hope you enjoyed the program, and we'll come back and see us again next time. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to the podcast at iTunes, and you can like us on Facebook. I want to thank my guest, Mark Harris. His latest book, Five Came Back, A Story of Hollywood and the Second World War. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas. I'm Gary Shapiro. Good night, everybody.